Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:45 p.m. It's Wednesday, February 28, 2024. Before we begin, I want to thank Juliana Singh, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Dylan Williams from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound at this time. I want to thank remind committee members in those rooms to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Tobin, my Vice Chair, Senator Keel, and myself, Senator Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 66, Controlled Substances, Homicide, Crimes, Sentencing, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the Governor. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Last session, we heard about its Senate Bill Companion, Senate Bill 64. Here to present the bill is Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law and Captain Sims from the Department of Public Safety. Ms. Schroeder, if you'd please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I am Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. Just to briefly recap, Senate Bill 64 and House Bill 66 were both introduced as a way to try to address the stark increase in overdose deaths. In particular, in Alaska, Alaska saw a very large increase. And just earlier today, I did provide your staff with an updated report from the Division of Public Health on overdose deaths in Alaska. And just to summarize, overdose deaths in Alaska remain high. And as we testified last year, a couple of those driving forces are synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and stimulants such as methamphetamine. So those are two of the larger drivers of the overdose deaths. Mr. Chairman, you asked me to briefly go over Senate Bill 64 just to remind the committee what's in that bill and then move to House Bill 66. Is that still how you would like to proceed?
It is. Thank you very much.
So just briefly, Senate Bill 64 had two main sections that were operative. Section 1 increased from manslaughter to murder in the second degree, a person knowingly manufacturing or delivering a controlled substance in violation of 1171.010 through 1171.030. So that is misconduct involving a controlled substance in the first through third degrees, and 1171.040A1, that is misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree, but that is only with respect to Schedule 4A controlled substances. So it is the entirety of misconduct involving a controlled substance 1 through 3, but for misconduct involving a controlled substance 4, it would just be respective to Schedule 4 controlled substances. So when somebody delivers those drugs in violation of those statutes and somebody dies as a direct result of ingesting that drug, then the person under current law could be held responsible for manslaughter, and under the bill could be held responsible for murder in the second degree. Section two.
On that specific topic, the first is what's the distinction between the schedules? There's one group of schedules, and then there's a second section that was the schedule for it. What are the drugs that are involved in those different schedules?
So, Mr. Chairman, in your packets, you may have a colorful sheet that on one side lists out the statutes, the misconduct involving controlled substance statutes, and then on the other side, it lists out the schedules and gives examples of drugs that are in those schedules. So the statute references the misconduct involving a controlled substance crime, and those crimes encompass a wide range of substances. So I can't say that it's never 4A and in the other statutes. Sometimes it is. It depends on what you do with it. So the reference is for the conduct and the substance. So if you look at the chart where it talks about the statutes, 1171.010, 021, and 030, those would be in their entirety. So if someone violated those statutes in their entirety, so there's no subsections that would be excluded there, and if somebody dies as a result of ingesting, then the person could be held responsible for murder in the second degree. And then for 040, as drafted, it would just be Schedule 4A, Controlled Substances. And 4A is benzodiazepines, so it's Ativan, Valium. Ketamine is also included in there. And 1A are the most serious level of offenses, substances, which are like heroin, fentanyl, GHB is in there. That's commonly known as the date rape drug. 2A includes peyote, methamphetamine, and cocaine. And 3A includes stimulants such as appetite suppressants, depressants, and certain anesthetics. So those are the level of drugs that we are talking about. Not included is 5A and 6A. 5A includes buprenorphine, and 6A is marijuana. Moving on to Section 2 in Senate Bill 64. This is the provision that prohibits good time for felony drug dealing. So if a person were to commit a crime involving the distribution or manufacture of drugs, they would not be eligible for good time. And then 3, 4, and 5 are the technical sections, the repealer sections, applicability and effective date. But so those are what the bill does for SB 64. It's very short, and it does two basic things. So if you would like me to move on to the House bill now.
Please.
So the House bill is a lot different. and I'll just kind of walk through the House bill section by section so the committee can orient itself with where the changes occur. So Section 1 is most similar to Senate Bill 64 in that it keeps the concept of elevating the distribution of drugs to murder in the second degree. However, it only limits it to misconduct involving a controlled substance 1 through 3. So the top three, if somebody were distributing and violating those statutes, then they could be held responsible for murder in the second degree. As we discussed, Senate Bill 64 also includes 1171-040, which is misconduct involving a controlled substance in the fourth degree, with respect to Schedule 4A. That would remain manslaughter. So we've got a division there. So misconduct involving a controlled substance 1 through 3 would be potentially elevated to murder in the second degree, but the 4A level would be manslaughter, which is that is current law. Section 3 of House Bill 66 is the definition section. Because the other body decided to break it up that way and have a graduation, and the word ingestion appears multiple times, and so it needs to be included in the general definition section for that section. So that's all that section is doing there for Section 3. Section 4 is an entirely new section. Section 4 says that if somebody delivers any amount of a Schedule 1A, 2A, 3A, or 4A controlled substance to a person who is mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware that a controlled substance is being delivered, that would be misconduct involving a controlled substance in the first degree, which is an unclassified felony subject to a sentence of 5 to 99 years. And that is part of the rationale for that section was because we had seen a few cases come in around the time that this bill was being heard in the other body where people had administered drugs to somebody for the purpose of doing other things to them, but had slipped, you know, drugs into a milkshake, injected somebody with something when they were sleeping for the purpose of keeping them unconscious for longer. One person was injected with methamphetamine for other purposes, and that person happened to be mentally incapable, so the person was targeted because of that and drugged for other purposes. Those are very serious offenses, and obviously this language does not require us to prove motive for why that's being done, just that it was done. This would also encompass somebody slipping something in somebody's drink at the bar, something like that. So if the person is mentally incapable, incapacitated, or unaware that a controlled substance is being administered, that would be elevated to a higher offense, an unclassified felony.
And just for clarification, for both the Senate bill version and this House version, both of them, all the conduct is a crime today. There's not new criminal conduct being identified. All these bills are about is raising the level of the offense, which has the effect of raising the penalty when someone is found guilty.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. I think there is one part of the bill that potentially lowers penalties ever so slightly, but we will get to that.
This is not creating new crimes.
Correct. Under current law, the conduct I've just described would be delivery. So if you were to slip somebody a Schedule 1A drug in their drink, that would be delivering, just everyday delivering.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, as I have a bill that's up, so I'm asking a question now. And I just want to make sure I understand that this definition section wouldn't impact any of the services provided under Crisis Now or Title 41 holds.
Through the chair to Senator Tobin, I don't think so. We pulled the definitions for these from the sexual assault statute, so these are definitions that we're familiar with and have not created any impacts on that as far as we know.
Thank you.
Section 5 is related, is the definition section, as I just mentioned, and we do reference the terms from the sexual assault statute, so these are terms that we're familiar with. There's been litigation around these terms, so it shouldn't be too big of a litigation headache to apply them in this context as well. Section 6, that change occurs on page 5, and Section 6 increases the delivery of methamphetamine from a Class B felony to a Class A felony. So under current law, it is misconduct involving a controlled substance in the third degree. This would increase it to misconduct involving a controlled substance in the second degree. Section 7 and 8 both relate to marijuana, the distribution of marijuana. So under current law, if someone delivers marijuana to somebody under 19 and the person is 3 years younger than the person doing the delivering, it would be a B felony. The House restructured this and tiered it a little bit so that it would be someone delivering marijuana to somebody under 18 who is also 3 years younger than the person doing the delivering would be a B felony. And then in Section 8, someone delivering to somebody who is 18 would be a C felony. And then somebody who is delivering to somebody who is 19 through 21 would be an A misdemeanor. So there is a graduation of offenses based on conduct there. And the misdemeanor does not appear in the bill. It's just the felony restructuring that appears in the bill, but you have to read it in conjunction with the current law. Section 9 is also in...
Go back to Section 7. Is this increasing the penalty for delivering controlled substances to marijuana for a person under 19? Is that increasing the penalty from what it is today?
Today, if the person is under 19 and 3 years younger, it is a B felony. This Section 7 is also a B felony. So it's drawn the line at a different age. So current law draws the line at 19. This amendment draws the line at 18. So it is a smaller group of people that would be captured by the B felony. And then the C felony would be somebody who is 18. Section 9 is also a new section. It is amending the sentencing statutes, and it is amending the sentencing statutes for Class A felonies. And if the conviction is for manufacturing or delivering fentanyl or delivering meth, the presumptive range would be 7 to 11 years. So it's a sentencing enhancement for that conduct. And then Section 10 is the applicability section, and Section 11 is the effective date.
Senator Keel, looks like you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Shorter, did the House bill address the significant issue that we discussed, I believe, last session, what I'll call the fellow addict problem, where you can have two addicts who are using together, and if someone overdoses, the one who has not overdosed can do everything right, can CPR, can call for help, can try everything, but under the text of the original bill would still have been guilty of murder in the second degree.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Keel, the bill does not deal with that itself. What I will say is that conduct of sharing drugs or delivering drugs is criminal already, and could be prosecuted. I would say that the statute is the floor. So because we can doesn't mean we will. And it we do factor in behavior that is done after the incident. So you have suggested that the person does everything right, calls for help, and tries to do something. Unclear whether or how we would charge that. That would be a totality of circumstances analysis that the prosecutor would do. There is no safe harbor for delivery. There is for possession for lower level offenses, but then the bill does not include that.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman,
I
was not suggesting safe harbor for delivery. But there's a growing body of cases in other states where that meet that exact description. And so, alas, not every prosecutor appears to apply the totality of the circumstances to their decisions, or at least not in the way that I think you would.
On that, just follow up on that topic. I don't think it's in the statutes today, but you can straighten me out if I'm wrong. But would it be the scenario that's described, essentially two addicts using together and one realizes what's going on and is doing all the right things? Is there currently an affirmative defense in that setting in which the co-user, co-addict then wants to show this is different than what you're trying to criminalize? Do we have an affirmative defense that would address that?
Mr. Chairman, for possession, there is a statute on the books. It's 1171.311. That is a restriction on prosecution. So if somebody is for possession, though, if they're using together, it's unclear if they're sharing, but they're using together, and the possession might be the charge. And the person calls for medical help, does everything right, cooperates with law enforcement. Then there is a restriction on prosecution in that statute, but it is limited to possession.
One option to address the scenario that Senator Keel is raising might be to amend that section of the statute to provide, and it might not be as a prohibition on prosecution, but it might be in the form of an affirmative defense that somebody in that setting could raise that affirmative defense, which I guess the question would become whether that would be a complete defense to the charge or whether it would be a basis to reduce to make it a lower charge.
If that's something the committee wants to consider, obviously we would be very interested in how that is drafted.
Right. Okay. Other questions? I don't see any other questions, and we have a small number to ask questions today. So I'm going to go ahead and ask, and I know actually indicated that Captain Sims was also available. Does he have anything to add, or are you the whole show?
I think he's available for questions, if you had any questions for law enforcement.
And I don't think we have any questions for him. Actually, I do have a question for him, or for either of you. I know much of the discussion has been fentanyl. Are there issues arising with drugs today other than fentanyl? Or is fentanyl the primary one in which we're seeing the overdose issue?
Mr. Chairman, if you look at the report, and I know I sent this late, I don't think that the committee has had time to fully digest it. But yes, just because opioids and perhaps stimulants like methamphetamine might be a large driver does not mean that other drugs are not of concern, and which is one of the reasons why the bill is drafted the way it is, to encompass a larger range and not be so specific to fentanyl specifically. So that report, I think, might be helpful in addressing your question.
Okay. Thank you. And I would note that we will distribute the document reference to the committee. We didn't get a chance to distribute it before the hearing, but we will get that distributed.
And I admit I did send it late. That is on me. I apologize.
That's no worries. I recognize we're not moving the bill today, so there's certainly time to get that to the committee. I don't see any other questions, so we're going to go to public testimony on House Bill 66. If you're on the phone, please make sure you're not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it is often difficult to hear what you're saying. I'll start to ask if there's anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 66. I don't hear or see anyone. I'm going to turn to the online, and online looks like we've got Michael Garvey. If you would like to identify yourself for the record, and you can, and any affiliation you may have, and I would specifically ask that you limit your testimony to 2 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Clayman and Vice Chair Keel. For the record, I am Michael Garvey, Advocacy Director for the ACLU of Alaska, calling to urge the committee not to advance House Bill 66. We fully recognize the pain created by overdose deaths and support the legislature taking action to address them. As we detailed in a letter to the committee, House Bill 66 relies only on a punitive strategy that will not reduce overdose deaths, while reducing resources the state can use for more effective strategies. Focusing on substance misuse prevention, ensuring that all Alaskans have access to high-quality treatment and recovery supports are more effective strategies that recognize this crisis for what it is, a crisis of public health. These recommendations are aligned with the Governor's Advisory Council on Opioid Remediation. Law enforcement also plays a critical role in reducing overdose deaths by working to disrupt supply and tracking overdoses to warn communities when dangerous drugs are spreading. But HB 66 will not help those efforts. Research, including that of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, has shown time and again that the certainty or perception of being caught is a far more effective deterrent than the severity. Alaska already has criminal penalties in place for the behavior described in House Bill 66. And the state can enforce them rather than pursue more complex prosecutions. Increasing penalties may actually have the opposite effect as intended. In jurisdictions where legislation like HB 66 has been passed, overdose deaths increase as people are hesitant to call for help. Alaska must bring down the rate of overdose deaths, but putting people in Alaska's prisons, where 80% of people have a substance use disorder, for longer periods of time will not bring these rates down. We oppose HB 66 because Alaska must prioritize its resources for the public health and law enforcement strategies that are shown to work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else online for public testimony, and I don't see anyone else that has come in the room since I last opened public testimony. So I'm going to close public testimony on HB 66. We will hold this bill for further review. Thank you all very much for coming today. Our next and last order of business today is Senate Bill 165, Defense of Public Officers Ethics Complaint, sponsored by my office. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. As I'm the sponsor of the bill, I'm going to pass the gavel to my vice chair, Senator Keel, for the duration of the bill presentation.
Thank you very much. Here to introduce the bill is Senator Clayman and his staff, Carly Dennis. If the two of you will please come forward and identify yourselves for the record and introduce the legislation.
Got to make sure we have our scripts coordinated. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Matt Clayman, and I represent Senate District H in West Anchorage. Senate Bill 165 would prohibit the Department of Law, including the Attorney General, from representing or advising a public officer or a former public officer in a complaint filed under the Executive Branch Ethics Act. This is limited to ethics complaints. while state employees may be represented or recompensated by the state for cases filed against them in an official capacity, it is a conflict of interest for the Department of Law to represent top officials who are accused of acting unethically. The essence of an ethics complaint is that a public official is acting outside their official capacity. It would be inappropriate to use taxpayer money to defend the Attorney General, the Governor, or the Lieutenant Governor if they acted unethically. Until November of 2023, the Department of Law did not defend ethics complaints against executive branch officials, consistent with the 2009 opinion from Attorney General Dan Sullivan, who we now know as Senator Dan Sullivan, said public officials could request reimbursement from the executive branch agencies in cases that they are exonerated on ethics complaints. SB 65 returned to this prior practice. In 2023, the governor changed the regulation 9AAC52.140 to allow the Department of Law, which is already overloaded and understaffed, to represent the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the attorney general in ethics cases brought against them. During the public comment period for that regulation change, the department received 120 emails and letters, all in opposition to the regulation and the proposed change, and none in favor. Senate Bill 165 would make those regulations illegal and ensure that public officials are held accountable if they violate the ethics laws. And the goal would be to return to the policy that existed following then Attorney General Sullivan's opinion, which basically said, get your own lawyer, and then if you're found to not have violated the ethics laws, we'll put in for reimbursement and we'll reimburse you. And I think that's the appropriate way to proceed. And with that, I will turn it over to my staff, Carly Dennis, to explain the details of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carly Dennis, and I am staff to Senator Klayman. Section 1 prohibits the Department of Law, including the Attorney General, from representing or advising the governor, the lieutenant governor, or another public officer or former public officer in a matter in which that public officer or former public officer is the subject of a complaint filed under the Executive Branch Ethics Act, Alaska Statute 39.52. That concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you very much. So just to clarify, Senator Klayman, the bill does not create an impediment to the reimbursement method. You would see that as still being allowable under the text of your legislation.
Yes, that's correct.
And I wonder if you could compare to the Legislative Ethics Act. Are legislators accused of personal impropriety under the Legislative Ethics Act entitled to public representation, or must they defend themselves at their own expense?
We have to hire attorneys at our own expense or represent ourselves.
And if a legislator is, I'll use the word exonerated, cleared of a charge, are legislators eligible for reimbursement?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. But we can find out. My impression is that request for reimbursement, but I need to look and see. That it seems that we have had some requests at legislative council for reimbursement, but I'm not sure whether those are ethics complaints or other matters, but I do have some memory that Ledge Council has seen some requests for reimbursement, and they have not, I don't think they've routinely approved those.
My own memory is that I don't think I've ever seen one approved, but that would be an excellent thing to get back for the record.
I would just, from my own perspective, I generally view that part of the, I don't know if inherent risk is the right word, but I think part of our life as legislators is that if there are ethics complaints, I at least work in the realm in which I don't think anybody's reimbursing any legal expenses I incur in defending those. And I tend to think I would have heard in various training that if in fact it was eligible for reimbursement, I would know that.
I tend to agree.
We will confirm.
Those were all my questions. Anything further from bill sponsor or sponsor's office on this piece of legislation? Seeing nothing further, I'm prepared to hand the gavel back over to the chair. I believe we do have someone interested in public testimony.
Thank you, Senator Keel. With that, I would like to open public testimony on Senate Bill 165. If you're on the phone, please make sure not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear, and it is often difficult to hear what you're saying. I'll start by asking if there's anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony. Hearing and seeing no one, I will then turn to the folks who are online. The first person, Andre McLeod. Ms. McLeod, if you would like to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you may have, and then you can proceed with your public testimony. We try to keep that to 2 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Andre McLeod, and I'm with the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. We support SB 165 to prohibit the use of public dollars and resources to foot the legal bills of the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general if they're the subject of ethics complaints. SB 165 prevents a law recently changed, which puts the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general above the law by allowing them to be represented by official state attorneys when they're the subject of an ethics complaint and are under investigation for dishonest and unethical misconduct. This idea to use inexhaustible state funds, assets, resources, and personnel to foot their legal bills and defend them, even if they're found to have violated the ethics law, was cooked up by the Dunleavy administration and implemented by Attorney General Taylor last year. It is bad government. Our society is governed by the rule of law. We're a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not the privileged elite. When public officials put themselves above the law, when special interests circumvent constitutional and statutory checks and balances to achieve special benefits, they do real harm to people, to Alaska and its people. Alaska's ethics laws begin with openings which we're familiar with. They're explicit that morality, trust, open government, and public confidence are basic ethical requirements to prevent political corruption. Those laws were set in place by the legislative branch and require the highest ethical standards for state employees. One reason ACPIRG took issue with last year's changes by the Dunleavy administration is with the process. These changes were made by the Dunleavy administration's Attorney General, Chuck Taylor, not the legislature. A couple of legal opinions from Legislative Legal found the changes to be illegal as they potentially violate numerous clauses of the Alaska Constitution, including the public purpose, separation of powers, and equal protection clauses. Additionally, we agree with former
Ms. McLeod, you're a little past the 2 minute mark, and I'm going to give you a little extra time to conclude, but I'd ask you to wrap up pretty quickly.
Okay. Additionally, we agree with former Alaska Attorney General Jana Lindemuth, who said that the Attorney General is charged with representing the state of Alaska. The governor is not the client except to the extent he represents the state. Allowing the Attorney General in his sole discretion to defend ethics complaints against the governor or lieutenant governor or the Department of Law to defend the AG is inappropriate and inherently inconsistent with the Attorney General's role. It's also an inappropriate use of state resources. Please pass SB 165 out of this committee so it can prevent corruption and further self-dealings of the Dunleavy administration and his Attorney General. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else online, and I don't see anyone else in the room, so I'm going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 165. At this time, we'll hold Senate Bill 165 for further review. If anyone is considering offering an amendment to Senate Bill 165, Defense of Public Official Officers Ethics Complaints sponsored by my office, please let our office know and submit them electronically by 5 p.m. on Friday, March 8th. We're going to adjourn for the day. I would note, depending on things I can't predict yet, we may cancel our meeting on Friday. Just give you a warning in advance for that. And with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:20 p.m.